The last section in that handout on discernment talks about helps of discernment. And they talk about five different helps of discernment. The first one, they say, living a God-centered life. It may seem obvious, but boy, we can lie to ourselves about a God-centered life. I saw this with seminarians. Seminarians can be phenomenal. You know, I'm living a God-centered life. I'm going to go to the bar and go dancing. Well, you know what? That necessarily may not be the most God-centered life. You know? Because you're putting yourself into a possible situation. Not that anything's necessarily going to happen, but you're putting yourself into a risk situation. Something could happen. If you're trying to live a celibate life, you know, going to a bar to go dancing somehow isn't going to make that necessarily any easier. Right? See? Lead us not into temptation. You don't put yourself, you know. So you have to recognize that, you know. So living a God-centered life. Personal knowledge of God and God's ways. How do you know that? Prayer. Mass. Prayer is giving time to God. Mass is being present to God. That's important. All relationships revolve around presence and time. So prayer, mass, reconciliation. Because our relationships are not perfect with God. And if with human beings we have to say every once in a while, I did wrong, I'm sorry, then why do we presume we shouldn't have to do so with God? Life with Jesus, spiritual direction. When you're really not sure, speaking to someone who you trust, who knows about spiritual things, talk to that person. And then, a reflective life. How do you have a reflective life? You have a reflective life by beginning with silence. One, external silence. What does that mean? No iPod, no computer, no television, no radio in the car. Every once in a while, you want to reflect. You got to get rid of all those things. Get rid of all of them. That's the external silence. But you're still dealing with the internal silence. And what's the internal silence? The internal silence of my thoughts. God, silence my thoughts. God, silence my emotions. God, silence my memory. God, silence my imagination. Those four wrap us around their little finger and cause us an umpteen amount of distresses. It isn't just external silence. External silence is necessary, but it's the internal silence. And when all of a sudden you see, you're trying to focus, and all of a sudden you're seeing, you know, your grocery list, that seems to be the big thing. You know, see the grocery list. Say, God, silence my mind. You know, silence this part. And slowly go back. Go back to God. A genuine openness to God. A genuine openness to God is revealed in the amount of joy you have. If you're looking around and you smile a lot, but there's no real joy, then are you really open to God? What's wrong? What's preventing you from really experiencing the joy? Okay? Like I said, remember when I used seminaries as a vocations director for an extended period of time. But I remember one person came up to me and said, Father, I pray for 3 hours a day. And he really was one of the most miserable, depressed people I've ever seen. You know, and I'm going, and it was just sad. I'm going, I spoke to him. Actually, I didn't speak to him. He spoke to me for like 45 minutes plus. And told me about all these things. And then finally I said, there's something wrong. There's something wrong. Well, what do you mean? I said, you just don't seem very happy. He said, I believe you pray for 3 hours, but there's something wrong. Because if you pray for 3 hours and it really is effective, then you're filled with joy. Where's the joy? And that was the issue. See? So genuine openness to God. Are you really being open? Are you really being open? And knowledge of the mind of God. And this challenges our preconceived notions of God. Always. And then finally, self-knowledge. I want to read this little part that I had written before. At times, about self-knowledge, at times, in order that we may do inappropriate things, things we know to be wrong, we will lie to ourselves concerning the desire, the goal, so as to be justified in doing the action. We will convince ourselves that the action will have the desired result. Yet once the deed occurs, the desire of the action is no longer an imagined thing, but is concretized. And it is in this concretization that the true desire of the action is revealed. This revelation will be the means through which the Spirit will convict us. The Spirit will convict us. Yeah. I said I was really doing this for good things. When it was finally done, it became very concrete. I saw it for what it really was, and I knew what I was doing wasn't good. And now the Spirit says, I told you don't do it. I told you don't do it. See? Then you're convicted. See? That's the beauty of God. He never leaves us alone. He doesn't say, oh well, I guess I can't do anything with you now, because look, you never listen to me anyways. No, no, no. He's really good. After you've done something wrong, by the way, hey, you. What are you doing? I didn't think you'd notice. Yeah, well, there it is. Okay? So, that's the beauty of discernment, is that if the heart tries to remain open as best as possible, then there's the possibility of even a wrong being corrected. Now, what is the wrong that occurred in the Carmelite thing? To tell you the truth, is this one right over here. Bring the gathered data to prayer. Is there one option we want more than another? Be careful of this option. Right? If there's one is there one option you want more than another, you know, if I'm not detached from all of the options, then am I asking God to know His mind, or am I telling God, this is your mind? See? Detachment from the options is absolutely necessary. I'm at the point of inner freedom when I'm detached enough from every available option to be free to walk down any path that God may call me to walk. And that's the part that I didn't do very well in the discernment with the Carmelites, is that I wasn't very detached. I was very much holding on to. Holding on to. It's the detachment that brings the freedom not to do my will, but to do the will of the one who calls me. Okay? And that's very important in discernment. Okay?
But as you were talking this afternoon, as you were saying, you've gone awry, let's say, in your discernment, but God still works with that.
Yeah.
As you were saying, you know, God is still working with you, the people around you down that particular path, he's working with them, and they are impacting you.
Right.
So none of that is wasted.
That's the beauty of God, is that, I mean, you can discern wrongly, but God still takes the discernment and uses it for His greater glory, if you're open to it. Most important, if you're open to it. If you've closed yourself off, you know. And to tell you the truth, there was a time when I first got here where I was a little on the ticked off side, you know, ticked off with God, going, what the hell is this all about? You know, what sort of road is this? You know, how are you going to figure that road out? You know, but you know what? As time goes by, and that's why discernment also is something rooted. It is not something that occurs quickly. It is not a quick fix. It's a time-consuming, patient act. Right? Because patience is to recognize I don't have control over the situation. My impatience comes when I desire, I want control over the situation, I'm not getting it. Now I'm impatient. See? So discernment can never be done quickly. There's always a time. Yeah. Yes. Well, no, because the Carmelites, like many of the religious orders, are reevaluating their charism, what they do and how they do it. So within the Carmelite order, there's a combination of, you know, contemplative and active, and how does that work, and how do we maneuver this, da 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 da. Remember, the Carmelites began on Mount Carmel. On Mount Carmel, you have Elijah, at one point, who says to all of the priests of Baal, I'll show you the strength of God. So, not on Mount Carmel, but before that. Before that, Elijah tells all priests of Baal, who are not the recognized priests, obviously, of the Jewish faith, you know, he says, I'll show you the strength of God. You say your God is all-powerful, then you create a sacrifice and have your gods consume the sacrifice. So they consume, they try to do this, and nothing works. Finally, Elijah says, here, let me show you how it's done. And then he does the same thing. He has the sacrifice ready. He says, not only that, God's going to consume it with fire, but before we do that, let's pour water over it. Pour a lot of water over it. Yeah, and then he prays, consumed, the waters, the fire, the sacrifice is consumed by fire. Well, Jezebel, who is the wife of the king, of the Jewish king, who is the one that brought in all of her priests, the priests of Baal, is some ticked off. Goes, I ain't gonna kill that Elijah guy. He really ticked me out there. I can't believe it. So what does Elijah do? Like any good prophet? Runs away. That's what he does. Run away. Save yourself. Right? He goes to Mount Carmel. And on Mount Carmel, he wants to pray. And he wants to hear God. And so he prays, and they say, you know, a storm passed by, but he wasn't in the storm. You know. And then they found him in the silence. He heard them in the calm of the silence, of the wind gently passing by. And so Mount Carmel has always been understood as a place of prayer. And so in the very early ages, a very early part of Christian tradition, you would have hermits that went to Mount Carmel. They became the Carmelites, and they were contemplatives. They prayed, you know. But as time went on, when Saint Teresa of Avila had her Carmelite community, she said, "I need sisters who are contemplative. My sisters need to have priests that work and guide them in spiritual life of my sisters." So she had the Carmelite priests come and be active members of the community for the sake of her community that could not leave the building, because that was part of the Carmelite, the sister spirituality. So there's always been a contemplative and somewhat of an active role in the Carmelites.
It's when it comes to movement of priests, in the past it used to be, it was easier in the fact that there were more priests. The moment one priest gets sick, instantaneously there's a shuffle. You know, I mean, I went to Camrose. Why did I go to Camrose? Because the priest went back to the Philippines. There was an empty spot. You know, I happened to come at exactly the time when that empty spot could be filled. There it is. You know. They normally, according to the Code of Canon Law, when a priest is made a pastor, he's made a pastor for life in the parish in which he's made pastor. But that can change according to the bishops of each country. So the bishops can gather together and decide yes or no to that. Now the problem, I mean, there's good things to everything. If you have a priest you like, if he stays for 25 years, well, praise the Lord. You know, if you have a priest you can't stand and he stays for 25 years, you're going, okay, God, I believe, I understand the cross, you know. See, I mean, that's just the reality, you know. So, but if you're here for 25 years or longer or whatever, then, you know, you are marrying the people you baptized. And you have a long-standing relationship which actually changes the way in which you respond ministerially to the people, right? Now, if your time is shorter, there's a good thing that if the priest isn't, you know, your cup of tea, you know he's not staying for too long, you know. What's the downside? You know, if the priest says, we're doing this, you just say, oh, it doesn't matter, I'll wait till the next priest and he'll decide and he'll make a colic and a different decision and da-da-da-da. Or, let's face the facts, I mean, when you walk into a parish, you walk into a lot of people that have their absolute need. So you have the liturgy committee chair who comes to you and tells you, because he or she's in charge of the liturgy. That's what they do. Their whole essence in the parish is this liturgy. So they come to the pastor and they tell you the most important thing, because that's what they do, is this thing that we want you to work on.
And then here comes Darlene.
And then Darlene comes in with the RCIA portfolio and she says, here it is. Boom. This is the most important thing. You know? And then Monica comes in. Here. Boom. Here's all what's going to happen. See, what at the very beginning, the first year, the first 2 years, you have to establish, because what you're doing is, you're recognizing the important ministry that each person is doing, and you're trying to understand it as the one mind that is able to direct it so that it has some sort of consistency. Right? It has some sort of consistency. Well, it takes a year before you even start to understand your comfort level and everybody else's comfort level in doing that ministry. After the second, third year, then all of a sudden you're starting to go, okay, yeah, they know what's your mind, you know theirs, and it's easier to do the ministry. See? So, not anymore. No, you always get somebody that would like certain things, you know. So that's typical. You know. Louise.
It's nice when you describe it. That's exactly the same as being principal.
Of course it is.
It's even the drama. The drama is the important subject.
Yep. Yep. It's, you know what, that's natural. I mean, do you think it's any different for the archbishop that walks in? You know what the archbishop gets? He gets the first year, he gets everybody that's phoning him, telling him how important, you know, Catholic education is, how important Catholic cemeteries are, how important Catholic health is, how important liturgy is of the Basilica, how important, you know, this particular thing that they're going to be doing, you know, that's his initiative. So he's literally bombarded by all these people who are all saying, can we do this? 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 You know, and he has to sit back, listen, make a decision. You know? That's part of the administrative element of ministry. But it's also that the difference in the administration is that it's never done on your own. It's always the discerning process. It's always going back to the discerning process and asking the question, is the reason I said yes because I like it or because God wants it? Is the reason I said no because, you know, like the person who asked me or the way they asked me, or is it because God doesn't want that here? See? That's always the discernment process. In a secular world, that isn't the discernment process. It revolves a little bit more around my trying to figure it out by myself. In this discernment process, it's always trying to understand this in and through and by the light of Christ. See? And so there are times you can get it right, and there are times you can get it wrong.
And as we were talking this afternoon, you ought not to get hung up on that step out of faith. I mean, the way I pray is I say, okay, Lord, this is what I think you're saying. And I'm stepping out in that. And if I get it wrong, I trust you're going to get me outside again with a 2x4. That's fine, and then I'll change direction.
Yep.
And that's terrible. That's the way we live the faith.
Yep. Okay, 9 o'clock.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you so much.